Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Hello, and welcome to the Hagman Report, the place where the truth cannot be silenced. It's Tuesday, July 16th, 2019. My name is Peter Barry Chalka. I've been asked by Doug Hagman once again to guest host the program today. And for the record, this is Hagman Report program number 1921. I'd like to begin by thanking our colleague Eric the Tech for directing this program on video and audio from the Hagman Report studio in northwestern Pennsylvania. I'll be here for the next hour. The program has been trimmed to 1 hour today, and Stan Deo, unfortunately, will not be with us today, as he is on most Tuesdays. Hopefully, he will be able to return next week at his regular time, second hour of the Hagman Report, Tuesday, July 23rd. Now, I will get into hour number one, the hour of the program tonight, in a moment. First, I know that everyone has questions like, where's Doug Hagman? Is he okay? When will Doug be back hosting the program? Well, as I noted yesterday, Monday, when I guest hosted, Doug has been a little under the weather since Sunday evening. And I received two emails from him today, one very early this morning, and the latest email shortly before showtime. And in that second email, the most recent one, Doug said, quote, I'm feeling much better than yesterday. I'll be back in full force tomorrow, end quote. So we can hopefully expect to see Doug Hagman back hosting the show tomorrow, Wednesday, July 17th. Now, just to review, 17 days ago now, on June 29th, Doug learned that his son, Joe Hagman, had passed away suddenly at age 36. And that news, sad as it is, may still be new to some viewers and listeners who might have missed it. So I wanted to be sure that everybody is aware of that. Now, I happened to be on the telephone with Doug that day within an hour of his first hearing the news about Joe. And even though I am physically thousands of miles distant from the Hagman Report studios, I felt a very deep connection to this sad news about Joe Hagman, who was a friend and colleague of mine, after all, too. And as many of you know, but maybe not all of you, Doug Hagman is a licensed investigator, what we used to call a private eye. He's worked over 7,000 cases over 34 years that he's been licensed, and he's a real pro. So when Doug learned about Joe's passing, he went to work immediately to investigate and to probe what had really happened to Joe Hagman. So for about 2 weeks and still ongoing, Doug has been consulting with local police and his own group of experts to investigate. Doug has let us in on a lot of what he has learned. On Monday, July 1st, Doug issued a 13-minute statement, both written and video, and they are both linked from HagmanReport.com. That statement announced Joe's passing. A week later, Monday, July 8th, Doug issued a written statement, which is also at HagmanReport.com. And last Friday, July 12th, in Hagman Report program number 1919, Doug spent the first hour again bringing us up to date. And that video can be viewed at HagmanReportLive.com or at the Hagman Report's YouTube channel. Once again, it's program number 1919. And as I noted, Doug is recovering from not feeling well. We expect him to be back here tomorrow. So on the show tonight, I'm going to start with a review, a brief review of the news and analysis that I broke here yesterday, Monday evening, July 15th, Hagman Report show number 1920. A review and a few more details. It's an important story. It starts with the antics of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the chief of staff in her congressional office. And by the way, AOC and her three colleagues, who are calling themselves the squad, have figured very prominently in the news of the nation in the past 24 hours. So this is very timely. Now, AOC's brain, as he is called, the chief of staff of her office, pretty much runs the office and apparently runs AOC as well. His name is Saikat Chakrabarty. The story goes on from him being described as her brain to help us understand how we got where we are now, a country where everything seems to be upside down and absolutely crazy. In fact, one of the guests on Fox News Monday evening used that word, crazy, to describe the Democrat politicians today, especially the ones who are running for president. And these four new representatives from the House of Representatives who call themselves the Squad. Now, I think this individual on Fox last night was a present or former member of the Customs or Border Law Enforcement community. They're crazy, he said. That's the only word for it. But how did they get to be that way? By the way, in an article in The Hill today, Chakrabarty, AOC's brain, is described as a snot-nosed punk, apparently by Representative or former Representative Rahm Emanuel, who served in the Obama administration. And he said this in an interview with the New York Times. And also today in The Hill, there's an article about the goings-on of AOC and her three colleagues, the Squad. And Senator Lindsey Graham commented that the Squad is a bunch of communists. Direct quote. I think that's very accurate. He also pointed out that they are anti-Semitic and anti-America. That's basically what President Trump has been saying in his recent tweets, which have drawn a lot of controversy and a lot of critical comments to President Trump. In fact, earlier today, CNN had as the text crawl on the lower part of its screen something like, President Trump issues more racist tweets. Well, that's interesting, of course, because to label his tweets racist is an opinion. Some people may have that opinion, but certainly not everyone. And it would seem that journalists should not go down that path. But that is CNN, of course. Now, my narrative on the program yesterday, which I'm reviewing here briefly, and an article that I subsequently wrote and submitted for publication, started with the news that AOC's chief of staff, the man who selected her as a socialist candidate for Congress when she was a bartender in New York City, and who ran her successful social media-oriented campaign that got her elected, and who now, as I said, runs her congressional office. This individual appeared in a video 7 months ago wearing a T-shirt with the likeness of an Indian, that is from India, a revolutionary activist from the 1940s who was a close collaborator with our World War II enemies, the Nazis and Imperial Japan. This guy on the T-shirt, whose name is Bose or Bose, and there, by the way, is a photograph, a still shot from this video in question from last December 18th. It shows Chakrabarty, the AOC brain, wearing the T-shirt with this Nazi collaborator named Bose or Bose, who is now long gone. Well, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting that AOC's brain thought enough of this character, this Nazi collaborator who actually met with Adolf Hitler at one point during World War II, apparently, that this is the T-shirt that AOC's brain wears on a widely circulated video. So I started, yes, there's an article about it on the screen. AOC's chief of staff wears T-shirt featuring Nazi collaborator. Took a while for this news to get out, but it's now getting out. So I started looking into all of this, not only the T-shirt and Chakrabarty, but I went back further than that, actually 57 years, to 1962 and the manifesto of SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, a radical communist group back then, SDS recommended that the movement, as they called it, by the way, they still call it that today. There was a fawning profile article of Chakrabarty, AOC's brain, in the Washington Post magazine last week. And it kept referring to the movement, the left-wing, super-left, communist movement, basically, is what they were referring to. And Chakrabarty is still part of it. And that's what he's doing there to advance the movement. But 57 years ago, the Students for a Democratic Society, another communist group, were also calling it the movement. And they said at the time, in 1962, in their manifesto, which was called the Port Huron Statement, written by Tom Hayden, Mr. Jane Fonda for a while, the SDS said then that the best way that these radical communists could move in and take control of the country would be to take control of higher education, basically as step number one, to influence the nation's colleges and universities as the best and most effective way to bring about revolutionary change in the United States. Now, they realized this was going to be the long march. It would take a while, and in fact, it took probably about a half a century, but they've got it now. Their aim was to get rid of free market capitalism and our constitutional republic, and to substitute a statist, authoritarian, communist dictatorship. And that, unfortunately, is what most of the Democrats running for president in 2020 and these four high-profile leaders of the House of Representatives controlled by the Democrats, that is AOC and the other three members of her squad, which they call themselves, that's what they're all into. A radical socialist Marxist communist transformation of the United States. And one of the vehicles they're using for that now is the Green New Deal. Now, back to the 60s. After the 1960s and the failed first wave of the so-called New Left to transform the country during the Vietnam War, these rats infiltrated academia, according to the SDS plan. A lot of them, many of them, most of them went to work in the social sciences, which really started to expand at that point. And even some of the hard sciences as well, like climate science, where they started to transform higher education to a socialist, Marxist, communist viewpoint. The best example of how this worked is seen by looking at Bill Ayers. Ayers was basically a dirtbag SDS revolutionary in the 1960s who went underground with his terrorist girlfriend, Bernadine Dorn, a.k.a. Bernadine Ornstein. When the SDS started to run out of gas around 1970 due to infighting and just the dissipation of the New Left movement at that point, Ayers and Dorn founded the offshoot group that was even more violent, called the Weather Underground, which advocated violent revolution. They and a small group of compadres, small cells underground around the country, made bombs, they blew up buildings, and deaths resulted. They were domestic terrorists on the FBI's most wanted list. Well, Ayers and Dorn and several of their associates remained underground, hiding from the FBI pretty successfully for most of the decade of the 1970s. When they eventually emerged from out of hiding around 1980, it turned out that Bill Ayers could not be prosecuted for his crimes because of purported FBI malfeasance in investigating the case and in investigating wiretapping, doing other things against the Weather Underground domestic terrorists. So at that point, when they emerged, what did Ayers and Dorn do? These domestic terrorists moved into academia at the highest levels. They got advanced degrees. They became professors, scholars, authors. They wrote well, especially Ayers, wrote influential books, textbooks on how to educate children. This is simply mind-boggling, looking back, that this even happened. But it happened, all right. Now, Ayers and Dorn also provided the launch pad, as many of you know, for their fellow Chicagoan Barack Hussein Obama, when he was moving from being a community organizer, deciding to run for state office in Illinois in the 1990s. And his first campaign for office started in the Ayers Dorn living room in Chicago. Now, in the past, through the 1950s and 60s at least, we had leaders in this country who came to the fore, like George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Dwight Eisenhower, heroes, patriots, scholars, men of intelligence and achievement. After the 1960s, we started to get unrepentant communist terrorists worming their way into the mainstream and helping to prepare a new generation of comrades like Obama to take power. How else can you describe this as crazy? And now we have the newest, the latest generation, a new generation of leadership, as they like to say, personified by what is being called the Squad, newly minted radicals like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her fellow representatives in the House of Representatives, Democrats Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib. Just reading their names gives me the creeps, and I wonder, what country am I living in? Not because of their color, their ethnic heritage, their accented English in some cases, or their national origin, but because of what's in their hearts and their minds. As Lindsey Graham said, they're communists who hate America, and they're anti-Semitic as well. Now, I want to emphasize something again that needs to be repeated. The buzzword today is that it's okay, all of a sudden, it's trendy and hip to say and to advocate for democratic socialism. 4 years ago, only 4 years ago, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent socialist senator from Vermont, he wasn't even a Democrat. He didn't call himself a Democrat. He didn't say he was a member of the Democrat Party, even though he voted most of the time with left-wing Democrats. He described himself and ran as an independent socialist senator. So 4 years ago, when he was running for president for the nomination against Hillary Clinton, he described himself as a democratic socialist. But he was the only one, basically, on the national scene who said that. But he got a lot of traction, as we recall, in 2015 and 2016. He did very well in the primaries that year. And if not for the finagling of the Democratic National Committee, he might have won the nomination to run for president on the Democratic Party ticket in 2016. Now, this year, only 4 years later, virtually every one of the major candidates for the 2020 Democrat presidential nomination is echoing the Socialist Party line. A few of them are acting like socialist light, perhaps. You know, Joe Biden might be in that category. But when you get down to it, they're all kowtowing to the hardcore socialist base of the Democrat Party. And what does democratic socialism mean? Is it compatible with our Constitution and our representative Republican form of government? No. When you look into, for example, the Democrat Socialists of America, the DSA, the largest socialist advocacy group in the country, which is now apparently the brains and the energy behind the Democrat Party, you find Marxists and communists. As I said yesterday, the DSA's website's platform and its policy prescriptions are all right out of Karl Marx. They are anti-capitalist to the max. The Democrat Socialists of America even offers online courses at its website in the study of Marxism. So it's pretty clear that they're communists. And they are providing the intellectual red meat for people like the Squad, these four members, Democrats, House of Representatives, and apparently, too, for a lot of the more, quote, mainstream Democrats who are running for the presidential nomination in 2020. So this is where the Democrat Party of the United States is at now. Its most popular and visible people are hewing to keeping to the socialist, Marxist, Communist Party line. Now, I have much more to say about all of this, including tracing the roots on what we are seeing now back to the 60s and people like Tom Hayden, Hanoi Jane Fonda, and California Governor Jerry Brown. It's a sad and a sick story, but it has to be told. And I told it in some detail yesterday, episode 1920 of the Hagmann Report, Monday, July 15th. I would appreciate it if you didn't hear or see that program to please look for the podcast at HagmannReportLive.com or at the Hagmann Report channel at YouTube, or for the audio podcast of episode 1920 at iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and the other platforms where this program's podcasts are available. By the way, I heard a great quote last night from, the Louisiana senator, whose name escapes me now. He said this on Fox News: "When you argue with a fool, it just proves there are two of you, or the two of you are fools." I thought that was pretty cool. Another great quote from last night by John Miller, who is apparently an African-American TV host. He was appearing with Tucker Carlson, and he said, in the wake of these intense attacks on President Trump because of his tweets about the Squad, John Miller said, "President Trump has done more for people of color than any of the four Squad members." Interesting. Now, I wanted to touch on this news because it's another thing that we have to be aware of as we're going forward, and it suggests that we're entering a red-hot period of instability and potentially more widespread political violence in this country. Now, we know that several weeks ago, in fact, I think it was Saturday, June 29th, if I'm correct, journalist Andy Ngo, spelled N-G-O, an Asian-American journalist living in Portland, Oregon, was brutally attacked, assaulted, and injured by an Antifa mob as he was trying to simply cover a demonstration in Portland. And this sent him to the hospital for about 36 hours, where he had a brain injury, swelling on the brain, and rather severe injuries. And this act, really, of domestic terrorism, which is what it was, for which apparently none of the perpetrators have been arrested, even though they're all captured on video. This seems to bode very poorly for the future in this country politically. But something occurred this past weekend on early Saturday morning, which is also disturbing. And it's gotten some attention, relatively little in the mainstream media, more in the new media and the alternative media. But it's another case, again, from the Pacific Northwest, which deserves our attention as a possible predictor of what's going to happen in the future, unfortunately. On Saturday, July 13th, an individual named Willem Van Spronson, also known as Emma Durruti, age 69, attacked a detention facility in Tacoma, Washington, that houses illegal aliens on behalf of the U.S. government. And there on the screen, an article from Heavy.com with two photographs of the individual in question, who is now deceased, Willem van Spronsen. And let's see. He was an anarchist and an anti-fascist from Washington State who was fatally shot by police while trying to set a fire with incendiary devices during his attack at an ICE detention center in Tacoma, Washington. Authorities say that Van Spronsen was armed with a rifle and threw lit objects at buildings and vehicles in the parking lot of the Northwest Detention Center. Van Spronsen was a struggling, you might say, Vashon Island musician. That's an island off the coast of Washington State. And according to the Seattle Times, Van Spronsen was armed with a rifle and was also carrying flares that he was using to set things on fire as incendiary devices. Police said that Van Spronsen tossed lit objects at vehicles and buildings, causing one car fire. He also unsuccessfully tried to set a propane tank on fire, and had he succeeded in that, that could have been a major, resulted in a major conflagration. Now, Heavy.com reported that Van Spronsen's friends say that he likely planned to die during the attack, and he had sent out a manifesto before his death saying, "It's time to take action against evil." He wrote, quote, "To my comrades, I regret that I will miss the rest of the revolution. Thank you for the honor of having been in your midst. Give me space to be useful, to feel that I was fulfilling my ideas, has been the spirited pinnacle of my life. My trans comrades have transformed me, solidifying my conviction that we will be guided to a dreamed of future by those marginalized among us today. I have dreamed it so clearly that I have no regret for not seeing how it turns out," end quote. Now, this rhetoric, which was issued basically today or within the last week or so, this reminds me of, guess what, the SDS and the Weather Underground in the 1960s and 70s. So there really is nothing new under the sun. Van Spronsen further wrote these words, quote, "I am Antifa. I stand with comrades around the world who act from the love of life in every permutation. Comrades who understand that freedom means real freedom for all," end quote. I guess freedom means death for some of these individuals like Van Spronsen. He goes on to say, this is probably the last time I'll quote him, quote, "I strongly encourage comrades and incoming comrades to arm themselves. We are now responsible for defending people from the predatory state. Ignore the law in arming yourself if you have the luxury. I did," end quote. There on the screen again is another picture of the late Willem van Spronsen. He died at age 69. I'm not sure how old he was in the photograph that those of you who are watching this program can see on your screens right now. I think it's safe to say he looked a little older than his years. Now, Van Spronsen called himself an anarchist, of course, and others in the community of anarchists, Antifa, communists, etc., they are saying in social media and at websites that they are, quote, inspired by his action. Van Spronsen was also once a member of the left-wing defense group, although it sounds like an offense group to me, called the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club. And check out this connection. In fact, this was brought to light by Tucker Carlson on his program last evening, that is Monday, July 15th, on the Fox News Channel. And there was an article about this in the Washington Examiner. Tucker Carlson accuses CNN of promoting Antifa violence. So the plot thickens, as we see. We have these radical, dirtbag, rat, domestic terrorist revolutionaries at the grassroots. And they're doing their dirty work. And then, wonder of wonders, it apparently is being... Well, let's see what this article says, how Tucker Carlson described this. Quoting from the Washington Examiner now, in an article that went online after Tucker Carlson's show ended last evening. So this was 9:09 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday evening, July 15th. Quote, Tucker Carlson said on his Monday night Fox News show that rival network CNN had been promoting the violence of Antifa terrorists by featuring them on their shows. Carlson highlighted two recent primetime shows on CNN, CNN Tonight and Cuomo Primetime, in which the hosts lauded Antifa's motivations and characterized their actions as a, quote, fight against hate, unquote. Carlson called the CNN hosts' support of Antifa, quote, pure 200-proof propaganda. It's an utter lie, and everyone knows it. It's also idiotic, end quote. Here's the money quote from this article in the Washington Examiner. Carlson also highlighted a recent promotion that aired on CNN in which host W. Camus Bell admired the weapons of an Antifa activist. Bell later tweeted support of the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club, the Antifa organization with which recent ICE detention center attacker Willem Van Spronson was affiliated. Van Spronson was killed by state police during the attack. He wrote a manifesto to friends in the days leading up to his death titled, I Am Antifa. Carlson condemned Bell's support of the Antifa organization, saying CNN was literally promoting violence through Bell's support, that is W. Camus Bell, the CNN host, through Bell's support of the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club. Close quote from the Washington Examiner. I mean, folks, is this or is this not mind-twisting, mind-boggling stuff? That this is going on in our country, this kind of political violence, it's very quickly brushed under the rug when it's conducted by someone that apparently the mainstream, the establishment, the deep state, the media approves of. And then on top of it, some elements of the media, the mainstream media, CNN, appear to endorse this kind of activity, with W. Camus Bell literally fondling some of the weapons of this super left-wing, quote, gun club when he is doing a report for his program on them. You can't make this stuff up. Now, in the wake of Van Spruson's death at the hands of police, an action, by the way, that is being investigated by authorities as the police who are involved are on administrative leave with pay, having dispatched Van Prusen before he could cause any serious damage. There is a group called La Resistencia, I guess. Is that Spanish? And they issued a statement on the shooting death of this Northwest Detention Center protester. So let's have a little look at this. Here's their statement. Early this morning, a person who appears to have been engaged in protest against the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma was shot and killed by members of the Tacoma Police Department. Today marks yet another death linked to the detention center and another death at the hands of the police. Based on available information, including the police scanner recording, Willem Van Spronson, the protester killed, appears to have been targeting not the detention center itself, as has been widely reported in the media, but the parking lot across the street from the detention center, which houses the NWDC's transportation infrastructure. This infrastructure includes a fleet of buses that transports SIC, immigrants to be caged at the detention center, and that transports immigrants from the detention center to the Yakima Airport, from which they are deported. Mr. Vance Bronson was apparently trying to set the deportation buses on fire when he was shot and killed. His actions sadly reflect the level of desperation that people across the country feel about the government's outrageous violence against immigrants, which includes the use of detention centers to cage migrants, both currently living in the U.S. and those seeking asylum. This death results from the federal government's unresponsiveness to the anger and despair people feel at the horrors unfolding both at the border and in the interior, and from the inability of officers to de-escalate rather than shooting to kill. So that's quoting the statement from La Resistencia. Pardon me, Spanish is not my fort or forte, as we used to say. Now, La Resistencia, formerly the NWDC Resistance, I see they changed their name to a Spanish-sounding name now. This is quoting them again now from their social media, is a grassroots collective led by undocumented immigrants and U.S. citizens based in Tacoma, Washington. It is an unincorporated association founded to confront human rights violations at the Northwest Detention Center and dedicated to ending the detention and deportation of immigrants, end quote. Now, isn't it interesting that the platform of a super radical group like this, which believes in totally open borders and in no bills to be paid by illegal aliens who manage to get here. I mean, they can run wild, according to this group. That basically this same political platform is now the platform being put forth by the Democrat Party of the United States. I think basically all of the candidates, or certainly all of the leading ones, are supporting open borders. Not only no wall, but open borders and decriminalizing the previously criminal act of people invading our country illegally. That would be made legal and okay by the Democrats who are running for president next year. And where did it start? Well, a lot of it started, as I've been reporting, around 60 years ago, if not earlier. But it's really picked up steam lately, and now you have groups like La Resistencia all over the place. We saw their ilk a year ago in the Occupy ICE movement, which in investigating that from a journalist perspective, I was taken aback to see that another ragtag group of domestic revolutionaries in Portland, Oregon, which I would expect to give birth to that kind of group because of the nature of that decrepit city, the People's Republic of Portland, as we fondly refer to it. But that kind of orientation, Occupy ICE, spread nationwide to other cities controlled by Democrats and with sizable left-wing populations. People have nothing better to do but to set up camp and live in squalor for weeks or months on end while promoting, quote, the movement. Now, there is a website called itsgoingdown.org, which is a digital community center for anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. a platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action. And this is their quote about the domestic terrorist Vance Bronson. This group, It's Going Down, said, quote, "What he did was heroic," end quote. Now, a bottom line or takeaway from my narrative on yesterday's Hagmann Report, show number 1920, was how the radical, violent communist left had identified as the number one target for subversion in the early 1960s and as the ticket to subverting the entire culture, academia, colleges, universities. And when you consider this, it becomes crystal clear, especially looking back in retrospect with the 2020 hindsight that is available to us now, sitting here in 2019. Because when you influence or take over higher education, you've essentially got it all. Because higher education here and around the world and its credentialed graduates feed out from the campuses where they have been indoctrinated and trained to infect the entire culture with their left-wing lunacy. They go from the campuses, the colleges, the universities, into the professions, law, medicine, into the sciences, the media, journalism, politics, law, and the bureaucracies, including the deep state. This is where agencies like the Central Intelligence Agency recruit from some of the best and finest colleges and universities in the United States, which, as we know, are now hellholes of Marxist communist thought. Now, Professor John Marini, who I've cited here before in the last 3 weeks, he enlightened us brilliantly on this last point last month when he appeared on Life, Liberty, and Levin, Mark Levin's weekly program Sunday nights on the Fox News Channel. Professor Marini has spent years studying the permanent administrative state, which is comprised of actually tens of millions of workers in the United States now at the federal, state, and local levels, the bureaucrats who pretty much run the show, who are expanding, metastasizing like a form of cancer in numbers and in power, unfortunately. And where do they come from? Where are they trained? Obviously, the universities, the colleges, universities at every level. And this permanent, it's a permanent government, basically. We've seen President Trump have a real problem with this matrix, which we often call the deep state. It's really the same thing, the deep state, the deep permanent bureaucracies. They're either the same thing or the deep state is part of this larger permanent bureaucracy. Now, Professor Marini pointed out in his interview with Mark Levin with total clarity how these enormous bureaucracies are largely immune from election results or the popular will. And that explains why, notwithstanding the election of President Trump almost 3 years ago now and his inauguration 2.5 years ago, he has had an uphill battle every day trying to get his policies that he ran on and was elected for supporting, has had such a hard time getting many of them enacted because of the permanent power of this left of center oriented permanent bureaucratic deep state. The members of this bureaucracy, this deep state, are fed there into their permanent jobs in the government, in governments, which it's almost impossible to fire them from. They're fed there straight from academia, where they've been trained essentially by collectivists, statists, socialists, and I would add by communists. These bureaucrats cite their credentials as social scientists or hard scientists, all of them trained in scientism, which is another substitute for religion, faith, or belief. Instead of a belief in God now, we have a belief in secular scientism as the ultimate. And associated with this, of course, is the emerging cult worship of Gaia, the Earth goddess, seeing planet Earth as a living organism, which it may be, certainly, but should it be worshipped instead of the real God? Well, yes, according to the new generation of New Agers who have also infected political and policy discourse in this country. Now, as I was thinking about all of this, you know, the permanent bureaucracy, academia, someone sent me an article which was perfectly relevant. It's titled Civilizational Suicide. Qatars, or Gutters, I'm not sure how that country's name is actually pronounced. Vision shapes American classrooms. Now, we've heard, of course, previously how certain Muslim countries that have a lot of money are influencing education in the United States. And we know that communist China is doing the same thing. And currently, there are about 300,000 students from communist China studying at the university level in the United States, and questions have been raised about them and what many of them are doing here. But this article I just mentioned, Civilizational Suicide, has an amazing quote from a book called The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom, which was published some decades ago. And Bloom discusses an incident in 1969 which took place at Cornell University, involving a guns on campus crisis. And Bloom is, according to this article, narrating the events in a way that help us understand how Qatari money into schools not only shapes policy and planning, but dictates which behaviors will be tolerated. So these are some quotes from the Alan Bloom book, The Closing of the American Mind, which was written, if memory serves correctly, around 1990 or in that ballpark. So this has been around for a while, but check out these quotes and see if you think they're not perfectly applicable today. Quote, "The temptation to alter the facts in these disciplines, that is social sciences, are enormous. Reward, punishment, money, praise, blame, sense of guilt, and desire to do good all swirl around. Thus it was in social science that the radicals first stuck. A group of black activists disrupted the class of an economics teacher in 1999, then proceeded to the chairman's office and held him and his secretary hostage for 13 hours. That was at Cornell University, 1969. The charge, of course, was that a teacher was racist in using a Western stand for judgment of the efficiency of African economic performance. There's that word racist, racism, which is hurled around 24/7 today. I mean, in recent hours, in recent days, what have we heard? Trump's a racist. He's issued racist tweets. We've got to impeach him now because he's a racist. Continuing Alan Bloom. The students, that is the students who took over Cornell, took hostages in 69, they were praised for calling the problem to the attention of the authorities. The chairman of the department, who they held hostage apparently, refused to proffer charges against them, and the teacher disappeared miraculously from campus, never to be seen again. This kind of problem solving was typical. Historians were being asked to rewrite the history of the world, and of the United States in particular, to show that nations were always conspiratorial systems of domination and exploitation, end quote. Now, what prescient words and descriptions those were by Alan Bloom at least or around three decades ago, because that's exactly the situation we have now on many, if not most, of the campuses in the United States. Now, this article that I cited, which was published by the Clarion Project, describes it this way. That incident, described by Alan Bloom, took place over a half a century ago. Today, it is more or less the narrative of most college campuses. The American education system has become so insipid and malleable that one need only whisper a microaggression or cry racism to manipulate the academic environment. The Qataris understand this well, and their funding of schools and programs not only inevitably influences decision makers, but also primes the next generation with talking points that undermine American excellence and interests. Bloom, that is Alan Bloom, describes how social sciences, a relatively new academic department, became the blank slate for people to write their stories. Social sciences became a battleground, but it didn't stop there. Departments of history, religion, and the humanities are all under similar pressure and influence. Their curriculum, faculty, and thematic work, and even the students those departments retain, are often shaped by funding streams. By the way, as I noted, the Red Chinese are also increasingly influential in many aspects of American higher education, spending billions of dollars annually to support American universities, which then sing the tune called by the Chinese communists. Just another of the existential problems we have to understand and confront if we are to survive as a free constitutional republic. But in short, the money writes the story. Now, this reminds me, and I want to draw a brief connection here to the work that I used to do reporting on healthcare, the medical industrial complex, the politics and economics of medicine and cancer, conventional and alternative therapies. And it reminds me this perversion and corruption of academia reminds me of what the late Albert St. George told me in an interview in 1981. He was around 80 years old at that point, and he had come to this country from Hungary in the 1930s, Dr. St. George. He was an MD and a PhD. He won a Nobel Prize in the 1930s for discovering vitamin C. A lot of people might think that Dr. Linus Pauling discovered vitamin C, but no, Dr. Pauling actually did a lot of innovative work with vitamin C and the other orthomolecular nutrients, as he called them. But it was Dr. St. George from Hungary who actually discovered vitamin C. In his later years, when I encountered him in the late 1970s and early 1980s, he was researching answers to cancer. By the way, there's one of my favorite photographs that I took of Dr. St. George at a really memorable event called Cancer Dialogue 1980, which was held at the then brand new hotel in New York City that was built by Donald Trump using the old Commodore Hotel right adjacent to Grand Central Station. That was one of the first conventions there. It was a four-day convention, Cancer Dialogue. And for me, it was the high point of alternative medicine regarding alternative cancer, because you had many hundreds of people attend this conference, as well as an A-list of guests drawn from the leaders the pioneers of alternative cancer therapy at that point. Dr. Linus Pauling was there, Dr. Albert St. Georgi, and many, many others. It was an incredible event. And there were even, there was a smattering of conventional oncologists, cancer specialists there too. The event was originally seen as a dialogue between conventional and unconventional. And the conventional part largely dropped out before the conference started, but there were a few representatives there of mainstream conventional medicine. And it was probably the favorite medical conference I ever attended out of scores of them over the years when I was attending a lot of conferences, both conventional and unconventional. Anyway, Dr. St. Georgi, who made a very impressive series of presentations there at that conference as he was researching innovative answers to cancer. And by the way, he was unable to get funding for his research from the U.S. National Cancer Institute or any of the other well-funded, bloated agencies or charities devoted to cancer research. I mean, here was a man who was another Nobel Prize winner and was an acknowledged genius. He was unable to get funding. So in an interview I did with him that I will never forget, he told me, you know, this is 38 years ago, he told me, quote, "The purpose of science has become to get grants granted and not to make discoveries," end quote. Now that, those words live in my mind and my heart today, because that describes almost to a T exactly what's going on up and down and throughout academia today, not only in funding medical and scientific research, which is what Dr. St. Georgi was referring to, but research across the board. Obviously, something like climate science would be a prime example. Do you think that the federal government or any of the leading nonprofit groups that might fund climate science are going to give research funding to a scientist, no matter how esteemed, to debunk theories of climate change, global warming, or global cooling? No, absolutely not. So yesterday, I think I meant to say this, I don't know if I did. The colleges and universities of the 60s and 70s provided the perfect environment, a sociological petri dish, to successfully grow the new communist-inspired ideas, including the social sciences, social justice, the division of Americans into hyphenated racial, ethnic, and sexual special interest groups, and environmental activism. So there you have it. That's some of what I've tried to cover today, relating what's happening today in real time with people like the four members of the Squad in Congress. How did they get to be who they are today? Well, they all made it through the university system, and here's what's happened to academia, the colleges, the universities in the United States. Coming to near the end of this hour today, this hour-long episode of the Hagmann Report for Tuesday, July 16th, 2019. And as I said at the outset, we expect Doug Hagmann to be back here hosting again tomorrow, Wednesday, July 17th. So prayers for Doug that he recovers fully in time from not feeling well and can be back tomorrow for a full two-hour show. And I'd like to thank you for listening or watching today. Peter Barry Chalka, getting ready to sign off. Please visit my Twitter at pchalka, P-C-H-O-W-K-A. Visit HagmannReportLive.com for podcasts and streams of this program. The YouTube channel of the Hagmann Report, HagmannReport.com. And also I have a little website at peter.media, http peter.media. So thank you again. Until next time, God bless all of you. And God bless America.